The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're looking at some of the ways motherhood changes the brain and the body. We're joined by science writer Kate Sukel to talk about the neurological effects of pregnancy and motherhood. But first, let's learn about the biology of lactation and breastfeeding. I'm here with Katie Hind, assistant professor of human evolutionary biology and director of the Comparative Lactation Laboratory at Harvard. Dr. Hind's research seeks to understand how mother's milk contributes to physiological, psychobiological, and behavioral development in human and non-human primates. Thanks for being here, Katie.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So first off, how does lactation work?
That's a wonderful question. We don't entirely know, to be completely honest. There's certain facets of lactation that we still are untangling. Lactation is a very incredibly dynamic process, where it's an interaction between mother and infant, or even mother and fetus. Basically, it's very hard to understand lactation in its entirety because it is a dynamic process between two individuals. So collecting data within that dynamic is incredibly difficult. So in terms of how does the mammary gland develop the capacity to synthesize milk, this is actually occurring before a female is even pregnant. So if you'll notice, women, during your cycle, as you pass through ovulation, your mammary tissue actually gets a little bit plumper. Sometimes it gets a little bit sore. And this is the mammary gland actually preparing just in case you get pregnant following ovulation. Okay? Because it takes so many months for mammary tissue to actually be able to synthesize milk, it wants to get a jump on it before you even conceive.
Right.
And then if you do conceive, that proliferation of mammary tissue, which is hormonally regulated, partially from hormones coming from the fetus, partially because of hormones coming from the placenta, and partially because of hormones coming from the mother herself, it actually develops throughout the course of pregnancy, and the mammary tissue expands and develops. Milk synthesis is actually suppressed during this period by progesterone, right, which is actually released by the placenta. And it keeps milk from being formed, but it helps to prime the tissue to synthesize milk. When you deliver your infant and you deliver the placenta, that progesterone plummets. And that's basically releasing the brake on milk synthesis. And within about 36 to 72 hours of delivery of the infant, you have an upregulation of copious milk production. Right. During that early window postnatally, when there's not copious milk production, mothers are producing colostrum, which is low in fat and low in protein, or low in nutritive protein, very high in immunofactors, which are proteins, like lactoferrin is an example. And this colostrum is really important because infants have still very, the newborn infant has a very permeable gut. And these constituents are easy to digest. And they actually prepare the infant's gut for being able to digest the more complex fats that will show up in a few days with the beginning of copious milk production.
We know what colostrum is, so what is the breast milk itself made of?
Well, that's another thing that we still don't entirely know. It's made of fatty acids. One that we hear a lot in the news, of course, is omega-3, omega-6 fatty acids. These are your DHA. They're really important for neurodevelopment and development in eyes. There's proteins, so both nutritive proteins and immunofactors. There's a variety of sugars. There's lactose, which is the main sugar in mammalian milks. And then there's oligosaccharides. And these are complex sugars that, very interestingly, in placental mammals cannot be broken down by the infant's stomach. Our human infants don't actually utilize them themselves. They pass intact through the stomach and are digested by beneficial gut bacteria in your intestine. And these bioorganisms, lactic acid bacteria or bifidobacteria, are critically important in serving functions for fighting pathogens and for making it possible for us to digest our food and bioconvert any number of nutrients like minerals, iron, potassium, phosphorus, things like that. So these oligosaccharides are things that human mothers put into milk that aren't utilized by the baby, but are utilized by the symbionts in the infant's intestinal tract. And these are quite interesting. They've recently come to light as being very derived in humans relative to our closest primate relatives. So humans are producing somewhere in the ballpark of 200 different milk oligosaccharides, whereas chimpanzees only produce about 30, and rhesus macaques only produce about 15. And there's a lot of variation among mothers in these oligosaccharides, and we still have very little understanding of where this variation comes from and what exactly it means for the developing infant.
Now, a mother's breast milk is highly personalized for her child, isn't it?
Absolutely. The milk that you synthesize is going to reflect the things you're eating during lactation and the things that you've eaten in the months and years previous to lactation. So the fatty acid content in your milk is going to come both from the food you're eating at the time that you're synthesizing milk and from fatty acid fat stores on your body from, you know, years in the past. Your antibodies that you're producing in your milk are going to reflect pathogens that you've encountered during your lifetime, and they're going to prime the infant's immune system for pathogens that it will likely encounter in its lifetime. Also, there's hormones in milk. So there's research on cortisol in milk, very significantly among mothers. But the source of that variation is still not explained. We don't know very much about how oligosaccharides vary among mothers. Protein, fats, pretty much anywhere that you look in milk, there's differences among individuals in these, you know, concentrations of these different constituents. And this is really important because, you know, the functional development of the mammary happens during pregnancy. And this means that there is some potential for really important crosstalk, both about the mother and the infant. And in that way, the mammary gland is responding to both of these entities, and the milk that it's producing is specific to each of those individuals. When you look at formula, for the most part, formula is very standardized, right? So there's some, you know, preemie formula and then full-term infant formula. But in general, it's pretty much similar from, you know, formula box to formula box. And it's reconstituted similarly for infant. So formula, while it's very important as an intervention if mothers can't or aren't able to breastfeed, it basically is erasing that personalized nature of breast milk.
Well, and that's one of the things that we hear all the time in parenting magazines and such. But is nursing really that much better for your children than bottle feeding? Are you completely shortchanging your baby if you decide not to? Or is that every bit as hyperbolic as it sounds?
It's a really tricky issue, obviously. And I struggle with this a lot because, frankly, the decision to breastfeed, whether or not to initiate, whether or not to do it exclusively and for how long, is a woman's personal choice about what to do with her body. What we can do as scientists is provide the best information about what the pros and cons of each are. In different environments, formula can be devastating for an infant, right? So if you don't have access to clean water and you're reconstituting powdered formula, that can be very dangerous for an infant. If you are living in America and have, you know, access to clean water and full health care, then the consequences are of less magnitude.
Right.
So it's frustrating for me because in the United States, there isn't a lot of support for breastfeeding mothers in terms of getting breaks to pump while at work or getting maternity leave. And so there's a lot of barriers to being able to breastfeed. And until we remove those barriers, you know, there's limitations to how much we can say that, you know, if you don't breastfeed, then you're hurting your baby. Well, if you don't earn a living, you're also hurting your baby.
Indeed.
So it's one of those things where under certain circumstances, breastfeeding will provide optimal outcomes for the infant from a health perspective, from a metabolic perspective. But we can't discount other consequences that go into choosing to breastfeed that may impact that infant's development. And at the same time, you know, formula is an incredibly effective intervention if mothers are underproducing milk, which is important to think about because some mothers will think they're underproducing milk and they're not actually. But if their infants are showing growth faltering, there might be a reason to supplement or transition to other food bases to maximize infant outcomes. And it just comes down to the fact that there's no one size fits all. All of the decisions have to be made in a very personalized kind of way.
What percentage of women actually can't nurse, can't physically nurse?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think we have very good, very compelling data on that, but I may be wrong. But so there's a recent study that compared time to copious milk production postpartum between the U.S. and some nations in Africa. And what they found was that in the U.S., among first-time mothers, a lot of women, about half, aren't producing copious milk production at 72 hours after the delivery of the infant. And that 72-hour time point is a really important clinical decision, because at that point, a lot of clinicians will step in and say, the infant needs to be getting more calories, and your milk hasn't come in. We need to start formula. And we still do not understand very systematically why there's this long delay among American women relative to women that, let's say, live in the Gambia. In that situation, about 4% of women are still not producing copious milk by 72 hours out, and we don't know why.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Katie Hind, Assistant Professor of Human Evolutionary Biology and Director of the Comparative Lactation Laboratory at Harvard. So you've mentioned studies. So where are all these lactation studies coming from?
You know, I make the joke that the sun never sets on lactation research, much like it once never set on the British Empire. And it's not hyperbole to say that, because you have the dairy industry is one of the leading industries in food agriculture. And some of the biggest producers of dairy are in Australia, New Zealand, China, Europe, and the United States and Canada. And so you have just across the globe a major dairy industry, which is very, very, very interested in understanding all aspects of lactation biology. It's a huge, huge industry. Similarly, you have a lot of research going into breastfeeding versus formula feeding, which we've already kind of brought up, and trying to understand what are the differences or lack of differences between these two modes of infant feeding. And then lastly, it's quite common that breast cancer research is very interested in how the mammary gland functions, because cancer is when it's not functioning correctly. And so research on rodent models of breast cancer and lactation are also very major areas of research effort. And then there's a small group of us that are interested in lactation from an evolutionary perspective and look at it in species outside the dairy, human, or rodent models. So I work with rhesus monkeys. Colleagues of mine work with hooded seals, hibernating bears. A lot of really dynamic research is coming out of Australia on marsupials and monotremes, which are the egg-laying mammals who don't actually have nipples. They express milk through patches on their bellies. And so there's just hundreds of scientists in all different areas that are really trying to understand a lot about milk. And one thing that's been fantastic is there's a number of platforms that are allowing a greater amount of crosstalk among these different disciplines and researchers so that we can augment understanding from the genetic, molecular, all the way to the organismal or even population or among species evolutionarily.
So a number of those sources that you mentioned are sort of, they're agenda driven, let's say.
Yes, and that's actually something that is tricky, because agenda driven doesn't automatically give it a frowny face, because we all have to rely on funding to do our research, right? So breast cancer research is a major source of funding into mammary gland biology. But the questions that they're asking are very, very specific to breast cancer, and the molecular pathways that they unlock allow us insights into lactation biology. The dairy industry is trying to maximize milk production at minimal cost. And so that is going to provide us with lots of food, but it also is going to minimize the amount of variation among individuals. And
right,
for those of us interested in Darwinian natural selection, we really want there to be a lot of variation among individuals that has some kind of fitness benefit that we can measure. And it's tricky. So I'm really interested in the dynamics between maternal investment and infant development. Dairy models are very limited because the milk that they produce isn't just there to raise their young, it's there to raise us. And, you know, you have to squint to understand what's going on and apply it to other animal models. And, you know, the comparisons between formula feeding and breastfeeding are getting very tricky because you have two sides on that that have very clear agendas. One where formula is, you know, a commodity. It's a multi-million dollar industry. And then you have anti-formula aspects of this conversation that no matter what, breast is best. And both ends of these spectrums are limiting because what's really important, I think, from my perspective, from my research, is to understand what's the natural variation among mothers. Why do some mothers make high fat and low sugar milk relative to other mothers? Why do some mothers have a lot of cortisol in their milk? Why do some mothers have this profile of oligosaccharides? What does this mean for the function in the developing infant? And from there, once we know more just about what breast milk is, what it's doing, how that happens, then we can make a better formula. And formula will better represent what mothers are making on their own. And I think that this is a really important goal because there are women, for whatever reason, because they have problems lactating, because they're HIV positive and shedding virus, and so they can't breastfeed without endangering their infant. We need to make sure that that intervention, that formula that's used as a replacement for these needy children, needy infants, is as representative of what they'd be getting from their mother if they could.
What about the idea of wet nursing? Having someone else nurse your child, for those of you who have never heard that term, does that still happen?
I don't know if it happens in the same commodity-based way that it did several centuries ago in Europe, in that high-rank women or women in the upper echelons of society would pay poor women to nurse their infants. And basically what this allowed to happen was when you don't lactate, when you're not mobilizing all that stored energy on your body and suppressing ovulation, you're able to have many more infants in a shorter period of time. Mm. And so what you'd find is these very wealthy women were having a lot more infants who did quite well. And these poor women were actually feeding their own children gruel and saving milk for the infants that they were being paid to feed. And I was actually just reading information about this, and the infant mortality rate of wet nurses for their infants was actually quite high. So you don't see that systematically. It's no longer a standard cultural practice. What you do see still quite prevalent, actually, in many cultures in the world today is this practice of allomaternal nursing. And this is a really interesting topic that has gotten very little research effort. And we actually see it fairly broadly among mammals that are socially complex. And this is where mothers will swap infants or nurse one another's infants in almost a reciprocal, altruistic kind of way. And this is really, really interesting because, as we mentioned earlier, breast milk is highly personalized. And especially in terms of immunofactors, it reflects the pathogen exposure of that particular female. Well, if you're getting antibodies and immune factors from multiple women, you are getting multiple inputs into developing your immune system. And this could have very beneficial outcomes for your immune development.
Interesting.
And these are hypotheses. We do not know this yet empirically, but it's a really active area of research. And I expect in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll learn a lot about this. And in fact, this is quite common, so much so in a number of Arab countries, where people are called milk brothers or milk sisters because they both nursed from the same woman. So even though they aren't themselves genetically related, they shared the same milk during infancy. And so they have these cultural constructs about this social relationship and milk relationship, if you will.
Well, since you're here, are there any breastfeeding myths you'd like to debunk?
One of the myths I think is most important to debunk about breastfeeding in our culture is that it's effortless and easy and natural, and women should automatically be good at it, you know, as soon as they have their infant. It's difficult. You can get sore. You can get mastitis. Infants can have trouble latching on. Some women can feel uncomfortable about it. And these are challenges that if there was a better public discourse about them, mothers would be better prepared and not be so devastated when they have difficulties. There's not a good cultural understanding of these difficulties. And so when women come up against them, they tend to be disproportionately defeating. And I think that, you know, if we accept the fact that there are challenges, but we talk about them openly, mothers can become prepared for them in advance and can have a better understanding of tricks and knowledge and sharing this among each other to maximize support networks for breastfeeding. And this is something that I talk about regularly with my colleagues and my students, in that there's this expectation that because breastfeeding is natural, because it's evolved for millions and millions of years, that women should automatically be good at it. And to that, I always respond with, you know what else is very natural and has deep evolutionary roots? Sex. And we all start out terrible at it. It takes practice. It takes knowledge.
I am totally stealing that.
It's one of those things that just because something's natural doesn't mean you're good at it. And I think if people had a better understanding of those challenges, we'd see more women overcoming them when they encounter them.
And I do want to mention, you also maintain a blog, and it's, I love the title, Mammals Suck at blogspot.com. Maybe just tell us about that quickly.
Yes, I am really excited about Mammals Suck Milk, because it provides a platform for both the dissemination among scientists about new findings at different levels of inquiry. So we feature stuff on the genetics of milk, the molecular pathways of milk, the differences among mothers, the differences among populations, and the differences among species. And this is really good among the scientific community because it gives us a chance to kind of be aware of what's going on with other scientists. The other thing that it does is that whenever there's big events in the news about milk that maybe isn't as reflective of the science as it could be, I recontextualize those news reports within lactation science and provide it so that it can be disseminated to a lay audience, make it very accessible. And this is really important to me because my research is funded by taxpayer money. And a lot of times I publish in journals that aren't available widely, or when they are written in a way that's not necessarily as accessible to people that aren't trained lactation biologists. And I think that this is a really important thing for scientists to be doing today, because if we aren't communicating our science to the end users and funders of it, then we're not really doing our job.
Oh, well put. Katie, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
We've included a link to Dr. Katie Hines' blog on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk about all the things that having a baby does to your brain with science writer Kate Sukel right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with science writer Kate Sukel, who earned a BS in cognitive psychology from Carnegie Mellon University and an MS in engineering psychology from the Georgia Institute of Tech. She's also the author of Dirty Minds: How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. Welcome back, Kate.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
So you were on the show a few months ago to talk about your book, and we spent all of our time talking about how our brains deal with sex and romantic love. How do you think that happened?
I guess that's something that we're kind of interested in. But, you know, sex and love, they tend, if you pay attention to the sort of the fairy tales and, of course, to the nursery rhymes, that sex and marriage leads to babies. So that's kind of important, too.
And that's the thing. I was disappointed that we didn't get to talk about our brains and that other kind of love, the love that we have for our families. Now, we usually think about them as completely different kinds of love, but are they?
Well, it's interesting. If you ask Sue Carter, who is this lovely, brilliant pioneer in oxytocin research and also in love-related research at the University of Illinois at Chicago, she would say no. She would say that the maternal bond is the biological prototype for all mammalian sociality. So basically, the systems, the highly evolutionarily preserved brain systems that are involved in that mother-child bond have now been sort of harnessed for all the other kinds of, bonds and relationships we make, whether that's, with our romantic partner, whether it's with a friend, or even potentially with our cats. And I know you know some of those cat people, and it's really the only explanation.
Then how is it like romantic love and how is it not?
Well, obviously, you hope it's not like romantic love with the lusty parts. But in terms of what chemicals are involved and what brain systems are involved in order to forge those bonds, they're the same. They just are being used in different ways. You know, much in the same way that you're riding a bike, maybe on a mountain bike, or you're on a road bike. They have a lot of the same gears. They have the same tires, etc. But you have to sort of use them differently or ride them differently to get to the same speed. It's really just these systems are preserved. The brain doesn't do a lot of redundancy. And so it makes sense that this, maternal bond is something that has been leveraged in these other relationships as well.
Well, romantic love has been compared to an addiction. So can we make the same comparison to parental love?
Yes. In fact, it was interesting. About a year ago, in response to some of the work that Ruth Feldman had done, she is a wonderful oxytocin researcher in Israel, a Time reporter had said something about, having babies is addictive. It must be because we wouldn't do it again and again.
Right.
And it's a good point. And you often hear mothers say, and I remember being told when I was petrified about going into labor, don't worry, you're not going to remember this later. And I think for most women, that's kind of the way, we have our stories and what have you, but we don't remember enough of the bad stuff that we aren't willing to go and do it again. And certainly there are some women that just love being pregnant. It is such a rewarding thing for them. It is so pleasurable that they do it over and over and over and over again. And, I think that, yeah, that is something that might be a little bit like an addiction.
Well, there was a study done on rats where mothers were more affected by their pups than by cocaine.
Oh, it's nuts. Craig Ferris, brilliant, brilliant guy at Northeastern University. He thought it was very interesting that rat mommies, the same areas of their brain, most of these in the risk and reward processing circuitry, lit up for their babies. And then in virgin rats, these same areas lit up after they got a hit of cocaine. So obviously there was something about babies that was, really, really compelling to these new mommies. And in fact, I think you can even go to YouTube and look it up. You can see these videos of how these rat mommies will actually bar press for their pups. Not even their pups, any pups sometimes, the same way that they do for food reward or a drug reward. But what was more interesting about where Ferris took this is he thought, okay, well, let's set up the grudge match. If this rat has to choose between cocaine and their pups, what are they going to choose? And it turned out that when they gave these new mommies a hit of cocaine and looked at their brains, they saw that this reward circuitry was actually dampened down. It shut it off. So it looks like there's something in our brains, or rather in the rats, it has to push down these other potentially rewarding things that would get in the way of nursing and raising these babies, because it's not like rats have access to formula or, necessarily a wet nurse in the outside world. If they don't nurse those babies, they're going to die.
So the mother's reward processing centers in the brain have rewired themselves then? Is that accurate?
That is the hypothesis. And certainly one of the things that is both fascinating and frustrating about the neurobiological research in parenting and in love is that it raises a lot more questions than it does answers. There just isn't enough work being done in it yet. And you think for something that's such a universal motivator and such a huge part of our lives, we would know more about it. But that is the hypothesis, that basically all of these neurochemicals that are released during pregnancy. All of these hormones come in and are actually sort of rewiring these circuits so that you can, one, see your children as being highly rewarding, so you can pay them the right amount of attention and help them survive, but also sort of, you know, make you less interested in other things that might distract you from them.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking about parenting and your brain with science writer Kate Sukel, author of the book Dirty Minds: How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. So one of the things that you wrote in the chapter on mothers and the brain was about the grooming studies done on rats.
Oh, yes. The epigenetic studies. They're fascinating. Of course, in any, you know, mammal, you're going to see a wide variation of parenting behavior. But Moshe Zif, Michael Meany, and Frances Champagne, and yes, that is her name, Frances Champagne, they've done these wonderful studies where they've kind of divided, you know, rat mothers into two groups, one called high LG or high licking and grooming. These are mommies that spend a lot of time carrying their pups, a lot of licking, a lot of grooming, a lot of attention. And then there are low LG or low licking and grooming mothers. And they're a little bit more negligent. You know, they still nurse and, you know, take care of the pups, but they're a lot less, I guess the right way to put it is they're a lot less cuddly. And by comparing these two categories, they found these very interesting epigenetic effects. Not only are things like, you know, age of sexual receptivity you know, what kind of partners how many partners a rat will go with later on in life sort of linked to whether they had a high or low LG mother, but also whether they would be a high or LG mother themselves. And that's kind of fascinating. Basically, some of the work shows that a mom who is a high licker and groomer, what she's doing is she's preparing that child for a world where they don't have to be as stressed out. They're going to be coddled a little bit in that environment, and they're not going to have to work as hard to survive. Those low licking and grooming mothers, however, you know, they're actually doing those babies a service with their negligence. They're providing them with heightened vigilance, a higher stress response. So in environments where they really need those skills in order to survive, they have them. I think it was really fascinating, Moshe Zif, when he was talking to me about a lot of this epigenetic work. You know, the old standby metaphor is always that if the genome or your DNA is the hardware, then the epigenome is the software, but the mother is the programmer. And that's kind of frightening to me and makes me want to put an extra $5 a day in my kids' therapy fund. But I think it's very true. Mothers are, you know, through their behavior, the way that they treat their offspring, are showing them what kind of environment they can expect to live in, and therefore what kind of skills they're actually going to need neurobiologically to survive.
Now, prairie voles have a very, very different parenting model than rats. Everyone plays a part in raising litters. So how does oxytocin affect those mothers?
What's interesting is it didn't really affect them all that much at all. In prairie vole studies, when you block oxytocin, parents lose the ability to recognize their partners, their offspring, and of course that's detrimental. We know that oxytocin is very important, and certainly having lots of oxytocin receptors has been linked in the rat studies as well to more engaged parental behavior. But when they tried to take some of those same findings from the rats and apply them to the prairie voles, which again, very different species, they didn't exactly get the results that they thought that they were going to get. So it's not just oxytocin. Certainly some of the rat studies would make you think, okay, they show that heightened oxytocin receptors and then also which directly lead to more dopamine. So spending more time, those high LG mothers actually get a hit of dopamine. So it's very rewarding, very pleasurable for them to be around their kids. So it's like a feedback loop. You know, being around the kids shoots off the dopamine, which in turn makes them want to be around their kids. But that's not exactly the same mechanisms at work in the prairie vole. And I think it's important because it's so easy to want to take so many of these studies and just, you know, without question, apply them to human behavior. But as Frances Champagne told me, the devil really is going to be in the details. Probably some of the mechanisms are going to be the same. It's certainly a lot of, there's a lot of overlap in the same brain areas that have those oxytocin receptors and release the dopamine when we look at changes in the brain in human mommies, but it's not always going to work exactly the same way. And of course, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, rat mommies nurse for a week and then they're kind of done with their babies. So we're stuck with them, oh gosh, maybe even beyond 18 these days. So.
Well, then that being said, what is the effect of oxytocin on human mothers?
It's interesting. Again, Ruth Feldman, who does this fascinating work, has taken oxytocin levels. There have been previous studies that have shown that love, romantic love, ups your oxytocin. And that seems to go away after about 2 years. When you first say you're in love, it goes way up, and then it sort of levels out over time. So she decided to sort of look at oxytocin levels across the pregnancy and after the baby was born. And she found something really fascinating, and that was that your oxytocin level pretty much stays stable from your first trimester on. And that oxytocin level is going to be linked to how sort of cuddly and nurturing a mother you are. So kind of like the high LG and low LG mommies in rats, you know, you see moms who are very cuddly, very engaged, nurturing, and then you see some other moms that are a little bit more hands-off. Oxytocin is correlated, a higher level of oxytocin is correlated with those cuddly moms. But what's interesting about it is they have that level before they even see their baby, before they may even know that they're pregnant. So it shows that oxytocin is important. It's a big part of that maternal bond. And certainly, of course, oxytocin has been shown time and time again to be very important in both the labor and delivery process as well as lactation. But here we see this level before, you know, while something is just a handful of cells, that's going to predict what kind of mom you're going to be later.
Now, there have been neuroimaging studies done on mothers, looking at pictures of their children. Maybe talk about that.
So Samir Zeki, who is one of the pioneers in sort of the neuroimaging of love kind of studies. In fact, he was the first to press with his study back in 1995 or so. So he basically just had a bunch of moms look at pictures of their babies. And what he found was that there was a lot of overlap with the areas of the brain that lit up during romantic love. So basically areas like the substantia nigra, the striatum, the thalamus, and these are areas that are rich in both oxytocin and vasopressin receptors, as well as dopaminergic neurons. Also, you know, he sort of saw this deactivation in areas of the frontal lobe. Again, he saw that in romantic love. And so he sort of gave him this idea that love, no matter what kind of love it is, has a push and pull mechanism. Basically, that specific kind of brain activation, what's that? That's denoting actually a softening of our judgment. We view our loved ones with rose-colored glasses.
That is so neat.
And I got to tell you, anecdotally, having, you know, been on the playground with a bunch of mommies who think that their kids are perfect and they're, in fact, you know, doing very bad things, it feels like something that's very true. And I think all of us, you know, it's something that we have to do. We have to see the people that we surround ourselves with as rewarding, or else there wouldn't be any sociality at all. And I think especially with human children, you know, that first few months of being a mom is crazy. I remember just, you know, walking around in a total daze, trying to figure out what I was supposed to do with this screaming, pooping little machine. And if I didn't see lack of sleep and cuddles and what might have been a smile but was probably gas as something very, very rewarding, I probably would have left him on the side of the road at some point. So
nature is sneaky.
Sneaky. Yes. And, you know, I think that it's something that anecdotally makes a lot of sense. But, of course, Zeki and anybody else who does this kind of work would say, okay, we need to know more. We need to understand how these brain areas are working together, how exactly they're formulating this. But the idea of a push and pull mechanism in love, I think, makes complete and utter sense when it comes to kids.
I think they mentioned that there was a difference between how a mother's brain reacts to a baby, her baby specifically, rather than an older child.
Yes. And in fact, also the way that the mom's brain responds to her own baby versus another baby crying.
Right.
And yeah, so those reward areas, they light up with your own baby. And actually, Madoka Noriuchi, she's a researcher at Tokyo Metropolitan University. You know, she basically had moms watch a video without sound. It was an infant crying for the mom and also infant smiling. And of course, one of the babies in the video was hers, another was a totally different baby. And they found that watching one's own baby activated orbital frontal cortex, anterior insula, parts of the putamen. And then when the baby was in distress, when the baby was crying, there was additional activation. So it wasn't just seeing a smiling baby. Then you saw all this activation in caudate nucleus, anterior cingulate, substantia nigra. So again, all these love-related areas. And it wasn't just a different pattern of activation. It was also stronger overall activation. And so these researchers from Japan, they kind of argue that this shows that the brain is really hard at work when you have an infant. And it's taking cues from the babies, basically, so moms can learn, adapt, and consequently meet all of those demands that are involved with caring for a baby. So here you have, it's not just these neurochemicals making changes, it's all of your interactions with the babies themselves. And certainly if you probably, you know, scan those mothers a few months later, they may actually show different activation patterns because they kind of got it down a little more. And what's missing from a lot of these neuroimaging studies, and what I wish somebody would do, is actually look at it over the continuum. You know, scan a mom while she looks at her kids or in some of these situations over the sort of course of childhood, because I'm guessing that there would be different brain circuitry involved with an infant who's very, very demanding in certain ways, with a preschooler to a, you know, grammar schooler, and then to a teenager. I bet all of a sudden you see crazy emotional and other activations, but nobody's done that work yet. And I think it's probably important. Our brain has to adapt and grow along with our children. And I think that makes sense.
We have a bunch of questions. Let's do a couple before the break. And a question from Jay.
Do women who become mothers through adoption experience any similar brain changes? How does this affect bonding with an adopted child?
Well, the neuroimaging studies haven't been done, but the work in TT monkeys and also in rats seems to suggest that yes, you know, even in adoption, just having the challenge of a new baby, and basically, you know, these researchers make the argument that these brain changes happen to better prepare you for both the challenges and rewards of motherhood. Because of course, there are both. You need to be able to read the cues from a baby. You need to, you know, be able to, you know, see them as rewards. And while you may not have the same kind of neurobiological push that labor and birth and lactation have, you can certainly build up oxytocin from cuddling a baby, from spending that one-on-one time with them. So there's really no reason to think that bond can't happen with whoever, you know, the child has that sort of comforting relationship with. There have been lots of epidemiological studies that have shown that the earlier a child is adopted, the more it can bond. I don't know how that would work out from a brain perspective, but certainly kids, you know, from the, you know, Romanian orphanages who all sort of lived in a room and nobody ever touched them, you know, they weren't able to form attachments because they didn't have that kind of nurturing care early on. But there is nothing from the biological literature to suggest that that can't happen with whoever's providing that comfort.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with author Kate Sukel to talk more about your brain on children after this.
What do you get when all the stuff in the universe can't account for the mass we observe? You get dark matter, that mysterious source of gravity that might be the only thing keeping galaxies from flying apart. On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, guest host Rochelle Saunders talks to Karsten Kraus, assistant professor at the physics department of the University of Alberta, about what dark matter is, how we discovered it, and how we know it's there if we can't actually observe it. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and my guest today is science writer Kate Suchel. She's the author of Dirty Minds, How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. And we've been talking about the neurological effects of parenting. Let's go to another audience question. This is from Plain Ray.
Is there really such a thing as baby brain?
So here's the thing. Mommy brain, you know, and of course, if you read parenting books or if you pick up parenting magazines, they talk about this. And I think definitely there are things that are going on, you know, that are making you sort of less focused on other aspects of your life. I have a great story for after I had my son, like literally 3 weekends in a row, I went to the grocery store and I left all of the groceries in the back of my car in summer. So all the milk, all the eggs, anything like spoiled. And this happened 3 weekends in a row, but it just so happened that by the time I got home from the grocery store with the baby needed to be changed, et cetera. My focus was elsewhere. There's this idea that motherhood somehow makes you forgetful, makes you somehow stupider. And that's not what actually happens. It just makes you more focused. So certainly in rat studies, what they show are that mommy rats, they kick ass. They are faster at navigating mazes. They are faster at killing prey. They are faster and better at doing anything that helps them provide for their child. And I think that that's, you know, sort of the same thing that's happening in human moms as well, because I could change a dirty diaper in the most explosive diaper ever, not even get a bit on my white shirt after a while.
That's the standard.
Well, you know what? When you only have one white shirt that actually fits you and like closes over your breastfeeding boobs, that's important. You know, you don't want to walk around with poop on it. I could, my son never happened to take the breast, so I exclusively pumped for him. But I could pump and do my work at the same time. I just, you know, I got into a rhythm with the things that were important for taking care of my child. But I did end up leaving a lot of the groceries to go rotten in the back of the car. So I think it's just a change in perspective, and it's a change of focus and intention. And you see the same thing in romantic love. I think you feel a bit sillier about it when you get the so-called mommy brain.
We can attribute most of that to sleep deprivation, can't we?
Well, the sleep deprivation plays a big role in some of it, but it's also these changes that are going on just through pregnancy. Of course, you know that your feet are going to get bigger and your nose is going to get bigger, and of course, your belly. And, you know, pregnant moms scare you to death with tales of all the things that change during pregnancy. We know that it's a whole body experience. So we're actually seeing changes in the brain as well. So when we talk about mommy brain, there are actual structural changes that occur, especially during the early postpartum period. The brain actually grows bigger in some areas, and others sort of remain the same. And, you know, the idea, the hypothesis is that since these changes are observed, they probably have something to do. They play a really important role in the development of, you know, good parenting behavior. So these are actual changes that are sort of, you know, going on. You see increased volume in prefrontal cortex, parietal lobes, and many midbrain areas. And these are the same kind of areas that might change, or you might see implicated in attention or focus as well. So this isn't just sleep deprivation. These are actually pregnancy-related changes, so that you can, again, I'm repeating myself and I apologize, but prepare for the challenges and rewards of parenthood, because there are a lot of both.
We have a question from the chat from David.
How is the love bond different with twins or triplets?
It hasn't been looked at from a neurobiological perspective. Now, in rats that have litters, and prairie voles have litters, there's none. Babies are babies. And I would assume that there's probably some of that in humans as well. As long as there's that nurturing, that comforting, I'd be very curious to see if twins sort of enhance, you know, the level of oxytocin or other brain neurochemicals, because you've got two to deal with. But I don't think there's going to be much of a difference.
So before I get to any more audience questions, I have to ask.
Yes.
There was very recently on the cover of Time magazine. You know where I'm going with this.
Oh, yes. God, man, though, I would still be breastfeeding if it would give me a body like that, I got to tell you.
So could you attribute some of that, some of the idea of attachment parenting and nursing for longer than is probably typical in our Western society, Could you attribute any of that to neurology?
It's entirely possible. I mean, I think, you know, the nursing and the cuddling and the attachment parenting, that's the fast track to keeping this bond together, to making it, you know, very strong. I get really tired of the mommy wars just because I think that, you know, deep down, all of us parents out there are just doing the best we can. And when I think about the epigenetics of things, you know, yeah, I think that there are some situations, some environments where it makes a lot of sense to do that. And certainly if we weren't living in a Western society, but we were raising children in sub-Saharan Africa or, you know, the middle of the tundra, you know, we might be breastfeeding for much, much longer too, because there would be a lack of food. I think that definitely because nursing for a lot of women is very rewarding, because having children is very rewarding, because cuddling is very rewarding, these things sort of can perpetuate and you want to keep doing them. And if you weren't shamed out of doing them, maybe we would all keep doing them.
And a question from Michelle.
How soon after conception do changes in the brain begin?
Oh, that is a good question. And the answer is they don't know. I imagine subtle changes are happening right away because, again, you are releasing a bunch of these various hormones. Oxytocin, you know, certainly goes up. You're going to see this luteinizing hormone, et cetera. And I think that that's basically, even if the changes are very subtle, they're basically paving away for some of the bigger structural changes that happen later.
So what would happen to a woman who had a miscarriage? Would her brain ever go back to its pre-pregnancy state, or are the changes permanent?
Pil-Yong Kim, she's now at NIH, and she was previously at Yale when she did this work. I asked her that, not a question about miscarriage, but would you expect to see these structural changes from pregnancy, say, 5 years after you have the baby, et cetera? And her answer was, I don't know, but probably not. She thinks those changes are there to sort of help you with dealing with the newborn. And, you know, as you go through different stages in parenting or maybe have a new baby and have to deal with, you know, multiple babies or whatever, there might be different changes. So I would imagine that what she would probably say in this case is that, you know, you didn't complete the pregnancy, so maybe not all the changes were made. The brain is never changed permanently, ever. That's the wonderful thing about neuroplasticity. Every new environment, every new experience keeps our brain changing and growing.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and on today's episode, we're discussing parenting and your brain. And I'm here with science writer Kate Sukel, author of the book Dirty Minds, How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. Okay, so this is the part I wanted to get to, because we have been talking a lot about mothers here. So how about fathers? What kind of neurological effect do children have on dads?
Well, they make changes to the brain too. And I'm very reluctant to say so because, you know, I feel that my investment was a little bit more significant in getting my child born. I was the one who got fat and my boobs blew up to 5 times their normal size and had to actually, you know, give birth. But what they show, especially with oxytocin, again, going back to Ruth Feldman's fascinating research, you know, couples generally have correlated oxytocin levels in blood or plasma. And what they see is that parents do as well. But dads get a hit of this important oxytocin. Moms tend to get it from doing that loving, cuddly, nurturing thing. Dads tend to get a hit of this when they're doing more of the exploratory, rough and tumble
right. Kind
of stuff. Now, it's not to say that sounds very sort of sexist and whatever, but again, this might be sort of the biological prototype. But, you know, we're sort of designed to give our babies, because it's good for them, these multiple types of interaction to help them grow and to help their brains develop. So it may be that they're getting that hit because mommy's doing most of the nurturing, but in a different relationship, if mommy was more of a hands-off type, daddy's the cuddler, and he would have, you know, that increased oxytocin for that. But certainly, yep, there are some changes happening in the daddy brain. In animal models, what they show is it generally makes them more bonded to the mother, more interested in the mother, and that also sort of rubs off on their kids as well.
Now, I think it's safe to say that there's probably a lot less research on the father's brain than the mother's brain. Okay, so, and this is what I'm wondering, is how much of this is attributed to gender, and then how much is attributed to just sort of that social construct?
That's a good question, and I don't think that we necessarily know the answer. Titty monkeys are actually really interesting species because in that case, dad is the comfort guy. Mothers give birth and nurse or whatever, but when babies want to be cuddled and, you know, nurtured, they're going to daddy for that. When they get scared, they go to daddy, not mommy. So I don't think that we really know the answer. Certainly, there are a lot of stereotypes, and if we look deeper, I think we might see a lot of species differences, and of course, a lot of individual differences from family to family. But again, you know, our brains are very plastic. There's nothing to suggest that two daddies, or a grandmother and a mom, or two siblings raising their young siblings, you know, can't have these same kind of changes. It's a great question. I'd love to know the answer.
We have a question from Lynn.
Has anyone studied the possibility of using oral oxytocin as a therapy for postpartum depression?
Yes, actually, there are some studies. They haven't been published yet. So, and it hasn't actually been looking at using oxytocin to treat postpartum depression, but actually looking at oxytocin levels and whether they are predictive of who will develop postpartum depression.
Oh, interesting.
And of course, the idea is if they were predictive, then finding the right amount could then potentially use that as a treatment. The thing about oxytocin, and of course, it's now being thought of as a potential treatment for autism, for schizophrenia, for anxiety disorders. It is an amazing molecule, but it's something that works so closely together with hundreds, if not thousands, of other molecules. It's very closely related to vasopressin. It can stand in and for vasopressin's receptors. It's closely, you know, can kick off these dopamine storms. So my concern with using something like oxytocin as a treatment is that we don't know enough about what the second and third order effects would be. And until we get a really good handle on that, it's really hard to say. It may be that you could temporarily treat that depression, but later on, what you would do is somehow, you know, mess with the bond between the mother and child. And then, of course, it's also interesting, you know, Pitocin, which is a artificial oxytocin, is used in a majority of births these days to help speed it up. So is that somehow involved? I don't know. It may be that oxytocin given at the wrong time might induce more depression. There may be lots of individual differences. So certainly researchers are looking at what oxytocin's role is or potentially is in postpartum depression, but I would think twice before I would use it as a treatment. As Sue Carter told me, think twice before you try to fool Mother Nature. And oxytocin is such an important molecule in so many aspects of human, you know, sociality and human bonding that you'd have to be pretty severe depression, I think, to mess with that.
One last question, and it's from Jim.
How does getting pregnant change the way a woman's brain responds to her partner?
Again, the answer is we don't know that much. The idea is that the changes that are happening in the pregnant brain in the mom and then also in the brain of the father are there to help them focus on the offspring so that they will both do their part, get invested, provide the resources, and help that baby survive. So certainly there's going to be a change in that relationship with a partner. But a lot of the animal studies suggest that having a baby with a partner actually sort of strengthens the bond between the two. Maybe not so much during pregnancy, but after the child is born. Some of that might be evolutionary. You know, you got a sure bet that this person can bear offspring or provide you with offspring. So you got to keep up the sexy times so you can keep propagating the species. But some of it may be that it's just, you have this great kid together, man, you're helping out, you're doing what it takes. You did the dishes and wow, I'm so hot for you right now. So
again, with the standards.
Well, and vice versa. You know, I'm sure there are guys out there that are just amazed that somebody was willing to push something through their hoo-ha for them and makes them love them all the more.
Kate, thanks very much for coming back on the show.
Yes, and hoo-ha is the technical term, by the way.
Indeed. If you'd like to hear my interview with Kate Sukel on the brain's response to sex and love, head to skepticallyspeaking.com and download episode 155, Dirty Minds. We've also included links to Kate's book of the same name. While you're there, you should probably click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google Plus so that you can keep up with show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the program, listen to past episodes, or write a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.